international loan finance. We are going to consider the nature of the euro loan markets, the international loan part of the euro dollar market. The euro dollar system was created in the Second World period after the Second World War. It essentially consists of an underlying interbank market. On top of that, we have a separate syndicated euro loan market and a parallel euro bond market. We're going to focus on the euro loan market. We're going to look at the nature of the structure and operation of the system, parties, rights and duties, liabilities and obligations. We can do this in terms of the underlying core documentation that's involved, and we will reduce this to a number of key core sets of provisions so that we can understand all of this. We will see on the outline provided that we can use loans for a large number of different purposes. We can have euro loans, multi-purpose and multi-currency facility loans, term and revolving facilities, credit lines, title finance, project finance, property finance, acquisition finance, asset-backed finance, and subordinated debt. I deal with all of that. I explain all of that in the chapter. The core point is this. All of these finance deals, there's five key sets of provisions we need to consider. Principal, the amount involved. Term, the duration. The interest, the payment, drawdown, and repayment. And then associated obligations which are attached to the making available of these facilities. We'll then go on and look at issue procedure, syndication, the nature of the relationship between the banks that make up the lending group. We'll look at lead bank and agent bank liability. We'll look at the loan conditions and obligations in further detail. We'll consider the nature of loan transfer. The core point about the loan market is that these are direct, private, immediate, bilateral obligations. It's a personal debt obligation. Historically, you could not transfer a personal debt obligation. During the 1700s, 1800s, we then developed tools that's now set out in the form of legal assignment or equitable assignment, although we'll see there's various other tools as well. Novation, participation, sub-participation, risk participation, securitization. We'll look at the various forms of mechanisms for transferring personal loan obligations. The key point to stress is that an assignment only transfers benefits. If you're transferring obligations, it has to be a novation. And we'll come back and we'll look at all of that. All of this is dealt with in the materials provided, in the documents provided, and on all of the supporting provisions made available online. Okay, we're going to do the same again now. I'm trying something different to see if this works. And then if this works, we might be all right. We had assistance offered, but we're not going to take the assistance because if we do, everything might fall apart again. So I'm going to try this. We're not going to have another break, so if you need to leave, you walk out, come back, don't come back, up to you, as long as you get the code. Right, let's do this. International financial markets and instruments. We can consider the nature, structure and operation of the international financial system. We've already looked at that separately in some detail. We have the money markets, the banking markets, we have the primary money market, the secondary money market, we have the gilt markets, and then we have the wider credit and banking facility markets, including the deposit taking and loan market. We have the capital markets, including securities and capital markets, principally debt and equity. We have the financial derivatives markets, alternative investment funds markets, principally hedge funds, private equity, sovereign wealth funds, currency markets, gold market, insurance markets, and commodity markets. What we want to go on to look at in further detail is the international loan finance market, the euro loan market more specifically. We can understand that in terms of this table. What we've basically got is we have a syndicate of lenders and we will have a group of borrowers. Because these facilities are so large, it could be 1 million, 5, 10 million, more likely 100 million, possibly a billion. Because these are so large, the banks do not want to lend individually, they'll lend in groups. It's not because they haven't got the funds to lend. They will have the funds to lend. It's because they want to spread the credit risk and then any other ancillary costs that may arise with regards to this. So we will have a group. We call that a syndicate. It's a syndicate of lenders that will make available facilities to a borrower and usually the borrower's group. Again, because these facilities, these arrangements are so large, you will rarely lend to one borrower. It's usually going to be a group of borrowers. In practice, it's usually the principal, the parent bank, or the parent company, and then all of the subsidiaries. What will then happen is, and it's an important point of practice, is that because all of the borrowers in the group are borrowing down, the banks will ask that they act as guarantors for each other. And we will see that in the documentation when we look at this in further detail. The only legal conflict that arises is that group members under company law are strictly not entitled to give open guarantees for other members in the same group, and then unless there's some commercial benefit for that. The point under company law is simply that each company is on its own and that the directors of each company have to act in the best interest of that company, including principally the shareholders of that company and then wider stakeholder interest in that company. It's not specifically in the interest of one company to guarantee the obligations of another, so strictly speaking, that would be contrary to law and directors wouldn't be allowed to do that. However, we can prepare resolutions and you will actually do the draft resolutions which will be signed and you will collect as part of what we call the conditions precedent documentation. We can construct arguments which justify one company in the group guaranteeing the obligations of the other. The core point simply is that because they are part of a larger integrated syndicate group borrowing structure, they can borrow more at a lower rate than would otherwise have been available in the market. So that's the principal commercial justification. Only because they are part of this larger borrowing group, they can borrow more at a finer rate, a finer coupon, at a lower price. Because of that, we can justify one company issuing guarantees on behalf of another. Otherwise, that would strictly be contrary to company law. So we will have draft resolutions prepared. These will be sent out, these will be signed, and you will collect those as part of the conditions precedent document, as well as separate, the conditions precedent will also include sample signatures and confirmation of who's entitled to sign all of the various documentation, but we will come back and look at that in further detail. So, the basic structure of the relationships that we're setting up is that we will have a borrower and a borrower's group. We have a syndicate of lenders, a group of lenders. We will have an agent bank to manage the facility when it's up and running. We have an arranging bank who's actually going to bring the parties together, set the facility up at the beginning, and then we will have a separate guarantor or guarantors. That's the principal relationship that we can see on this table. Borrower, borrower's group, syndicate lenders, guarantor group, as well as an agent bank and an arranging bank. Now, what we have to do in practice is we have to clearly distinguish the nature of the relationship and the roles and responsibilities of the arranging bank and of the agent bank. The arranging bank will be one of the large investment banks, such as Goldman Sachs. It's going to come in and set the facility up. It's going to receive a large fee for this, usually, typically 0.5%. So this is a 100 billion facility. It's going to receive 0.5% of that. It gets a high fee after it sets the facility up. It will, as part of the negotiation process and as part of the marketing process, it will tell all of the other banks which are going to make up the syndicate, we are part of this syndicate and we are going to be making funds available with you so that you have a sort of a group, a common interest. However, in practice, what will happen is the arranging bank usually drops out at a very early stage. It will actually draft transfer documentation so that when the documentation, the loan agreement is actually signed and comes into effect and the borrower starts drawing down under this, the arranging bank usually has left. It will bring in another bank to stand in its place to make available its share of the facilities. It raises its funds by basically charging for the arranging fee on each deal. It doesn't want to actually do the lending and then get the interest fee for providing the lending itself. So very often the arranging bank comes in, it brings the syndicate together, it is a member of the syndicate initially, but it will actually, before we enter into the documentation and the loan agreements actually signed, it will usually have transferred on its lending commitments, its lending obligations, so another bank will come in. By way of example, if this is a 100 million facility, we could have, for example, 10 banks lending 10 million each, 100 million. They don't have to be equal. It can be any proportion. In practice, and for our purposes, we'll just assume they're all equal. We will have one borrower and nine subsidiaries. So we have 10 borrowers making up the borrowers group. We will have an arranging bank and we will have an agent bank. If it's 100 million, each of the borrowers can draw down any amount up to that 100 million. We will have the 10 banks each providing 10 million each. The example I was giving is that very often what will happen is the arranging bank will bring in another bank that will come in and make that 10 million available, usually a commercial bank. So the investment bank is going to be focusing on securities business, underwriting business, setting up these larger facilities in both the loan market and the capital market. It makes its income through the fees it can charge as the arranging bank. So it wants to come in, set the deal up, enter into all the documentation, have everything executed and signed, and then move on to the next deal. A commercial bank will then probably, highly likely, come in and make available the funds that the arranging bank said it was going to provide under the syndicate, but it will stand down as of the day of the signing very often, and another replacement bank will come in and make those funds available. Now, just by way of example, just by way of illustration, how many loans do we have then? If we have 10 borrowers and we have 10 banks, we have one loan agreement. In law, is that one loan? Or are there multiple? What actually happens is the loan agreement only sets up the borrowing facility. The actual loans, the lending commitments themselves, are set out in what we call the drawdowns, the utilization requests. So what will happen is this: each borrower will send to the agent bank a utilization request, a drawdown, and drawdown under the facility. Each one of those is the separate loan. Not the loan agreement as a whole, it's only a structure, a legal arrangement which makes available the entitlement to draw down. The drawdown themselves actually creates the legal obligations. Those are the separate loans. So how many drawdowns will we have? In this example, let's assume this is a 20-year drawdown. It's a 20-year term loan. But what we're going to see is this. There's both a term loan, which is for a fixed term, as well as a supporting what we call a revolver. There's a revolving facility as well. The term loan, you draw down, you repay, you do not draw down again. It could be for the full 20 years. The revolver, these are short rolling funds that you draw down, repay, draw down, repay. You might do this every 6 months, every 3 months, or even every month. So you have both a term loan, which is for a fixed duration, and you have a revolver. Now, in our example here, we've got 10 banks and 10 borrowers, two facilities, an A and a B. How many loans? Minimum 200. Minimum. However, what will happen is this. The term loan will be made available during a commitment period. For example, the first 2 years. So any of the 10 borrowers can draw down any amount up to 100 million over a 2 year period, possibly every month. So how many loans is that? That's 10 times 10, 100, times 12 times 2. So that's already 2,400, isn't it? Just on the A, the facility A, 2,400 separate loans. Each borrower can go in and draw down a certain amount up to the maximum, and they can do that every month for up to 2 years. So it's 10 times 10, times 2, times 12. That's 2,400. What about the term B, the revolver? It all depends how long the revolver is available for. is the revolver only going to be for a limited time, such as the same as the commitment period, or for the whole length of the facility? If the revolver is only for 2 years again, it would be 2,400 again, the same amount. 100 times 2 times 12. However, if it's available for the full 20 years, all of these borrowers can draw down every month for up to 20 years. That's 20 times 12, right? The total figure is then 24,000. And if we add the 24,000B with the 2,400A, we get a total of 26,400 loans. Theoretically available under this facility. 26,400 loans. All governed by a single document, all governed by identical terms and conditions. But strictly speaking, there are 24,600 drawdowns. So there's 26,400 separate legal obligations, which creates repayment obligations. And that's what we have to manage under all of this documentation. What is the liability of the parties? The syndicate banks, are they several or joint and several? If they're joint and several, that means each bank has to sign behind each other bank. But in practice and in law, it's several. So if one of the banks drops out, what do the other banks have to lend? They only have to lend up to their commitment. And their commitment will be set out in the schedule, usually schedule 1 or schedule 2 to the document. They only have to lend up to their commitment. The banks do not have to compensate for another bank standing down, dropping down, or dropping out, or not making funds available. In practice, what will happen is the bank that's retiring will notify the agent bank, and the agent bank will find a replacement bank. And until the replacement bank is found, the borrower can only draw down up to the 90 million. The obligations are several, they're not joint and several. That's the basic relationship. What we now need to understand is all of the additional provisions that could apply around that. All of this is dealt with in the chapter. Let's start on the top right. What can we use these loans for? These are term loans with a supporting revolving facility. We can use them as part of the Euroloan system. We can use them for multi-purpose facilities. A MOF is when we have a number of facilities made available for a particular borrower. There will be a series of specific types of lending commitments that are combined. This will usually include a term advance, the term loan. It will also include what we call a swing line facility. A swing line is a short loan that you use to transfer between lending facilities. So if you have four or five different facilities in place and you're moving between them, you can borrow under the swing line to get temporary financing, for example, for a week, as you set up each of these facilities, as you move funds between them. You will also have commercial paper or Euro commercial paper that we looked at before. You'll also have a banker's acceptances program, which we also mentioned as part of the money markets. A banker's acceptance allows the company to issue bills of exchange. Those bills of exchange are accepted and can then be discounted. They're basically as good as cash. And also, we will have, usually in practice, what we call a medium-term note facility. So we'll actually combine bank lending with capital markets. In the MOF, multi-option facility, or a MOFE, multi-option funding facility, we will combine credit arrangements, credit relationships, and capital market notes as well. So there's usually going to be a medium-term note facility as part of this, so that the company can also issue 5-year notes, 10-year notes, or 15-year notes. Why do you have both? Simply because you provide extra flexibility. In practice, what's the general rule? The general rule is that if you can borrow in the capital markets, you can usually always get a finer coupon rate. You can always borrow cheaper. You can borrow more cheaper in the capital markets than you can in the banking markets. We still need the banking markets if there's any problems with the capital markets, as there are just now, for example, or if there's any disruption and rates are very high, or if there's any credit problem with the borrowing group. If there are any issues with the borrowing group and it's not got perfect credit standing, you will not use the capital markets because you'll have to pay large premia on the coupon rates that you provide, and the coupon is the interest you're paying on your notes. If there's any issues here, with the borrowing, the borrower's group, their business model, or their condition, or their relationship with the markets at any point in time, you will go to the banking markets. So the general rule always is you can borrow more cheaper in the capital markets, but if there's any issues, any disruption, or any credit difficulties of any form, you go back to the banking markets. The MOF provides both. It's a combination of longer and shorter facilities dealing with both banking facilities and with capital market facilities. We can also use these term loan and revolving facilities with credit lines. A credit line is essentially a form of overdraft. With a bank providing funds to a company, you don't call that an overdraft, you call that a credit line. We can have advisory credit lines, we can have committed credit lines, means it's entitled, the borrower can draw down up to a certain amount, agreed in advance. If it's a non-advised, or if it's only advised and not committed, there's funds there, but they may not be available on the particular day, depending upon to what extent this is confirmed or not confirmed. We can also use this in project finance deals. These are large infrastructure deals, building power stations, nuclear reactor, any large plant of any form. With project finance, the whole purpose is you repay the loan from the income generated by the project, so the project effectively pays itself. We call that non-recourse funding because you don't go back to the borrower directly. The repayment all comes from the income generated by the project. In practice, the borrower will actually, in these cases, usually be a special purpose vehicle, an SPV, so it doesn't have any assets apart from the project assets in any case anyway. The banks will take security over all aspects of the project, everything that's held by the SPV, so that they can get maximum recovery. But it's non-recourse, which means you only go against the SPV. You do not go against the other companies that may own the SPV. We can also use this in property finance. You will have a rental income there, which can be very valuable, as well as the property may go up in value over time. So that's a very important area of investment. We can also use these in acquisition finance. When we're taking over companies, mergers and acquisitions, we can have different grades of debt, senior, mezzanine, meaning middle, or lower, junior, and we can structure various lending facilities around that. You'll see there senior, mezzanine, and junior on the right-hand side. We can also use this in securitization transactions. In securitization, we're taking large pools of assets from the banking or credit market, and we're moving those into the capital market. Again, we use an SPV, a special purpose vehicle. The special purpose vehicle is going to issue notes into the market, usually medium term notes, 5, 10, 15, 20 year notes. It uses that to pay for this pool, so we move this asset pool over to the SPV. It holds the pool. It acquires the asset pool from the originating bank. This might be 5,000 mortgages, 10,000 student loans, 10,000, 15,000 car loans, any credit assets governed by the same terms and conditions, we can turn into an asset pool and we move that pool, generally by legal assignment or equitable assignment. In this particular case, what we're going to see is this. Assignment is carried out under the Law of Property Act 1925 and Section 26 of the Law of Property Act. The assignment, for it to be legal, has to be in writing, has to be for an unconditional amount, and you have to give notice to the borrower. If you don't give notice to the borrower, it's only an equitable assignment rather than a legal assignment. An equitable assignment is as effective, except that you don't have immediate priority and you can lose priority. With an equitable assignment, if the transferee then transfers the same asset to another party and that party gives notice to the borrower before you do, you lose your rights, you lose your priority. With full legal assignment, you get automatic priority. With equitable assignment, you don't get priority until you give notice. But very often in practice, we don't give notice. Certainly in these large complex deals, specifically with the project finance deals, we don't need to give notice because it's a closed structure. There's no other outside parties involved, therefore parties can trust themselves and they can rely on the equitable rather than the legal. The main reason the banks don't want to give notice is because it doesn't look good with their clients, with their customers. You have negotiated with your bank to take a 40-year mortgage. You do not want the bank to tell you in a letter, I've just sold your 40-year mortgage to an SPV company in the Cayman Islands. Thank you very much. We'd like to keep your business. Please don't leave me. The banks want to keep credit standing. They want to keep the relationship with their customers so they don't give notice, so they rely on equitable assignment rather than legal. Because it's a closed deal, it's very unlikely that you could lose your priority otherwise. And then also in subordinated debt structures, where we have lending arrangements, subordinated debt simply means we postpone repayment to other parties so that you create a form of hierarchy of creditors, and the subordinated debt goes at the back of this. So these loan facilities, these term loans that we're talking about with the supporting revolvers, we can use in almost any other finance area. And this is an absolute core mechanism, core relationship, core set of transactions that we use all of the time in the finance area at the national and at the international levels. This is the basic structure for 50-60% of all lending. The rest of it is then capital markets, including particularly the bonds that we consider separately. In terms of other points to highlight, so international financial centres, the main centre for the international loan market is still London, although business can be conducted in New York, Tokyo, Frankfurt and Shanghai. For regulatory purposes and just because experience and liquidity in the markets, most of the large deals are still done through London. London is still the centre for the international banking market. We've already mentioned the lenders, the borrowers and the term loans. The core sets of provisions. We have five key sets of issues and terms and conditions that we have to build into the documentation that we have to understand. The principal is the amount. The term is the duration. The drawdown is how the funds are made available. Usually, you may have assumed it's 100 million, therefore the 100 million is paid and made available immediately on the signing of the loan agreement, and that's everything concluded. In practice, the borrowers don't need the 100 million up front, so you have a drawdown. You can do that in tranching, and then you can have that over an availability period. For example, we said two years before, and you could draw down once a month up to a two-year period. So it's a 100 million facility that can be drawn down for up to 2 years by serving notices every month for up to that two-month period, okay? Interest can either be fixed or floating. In practice, it's usually floating because we calculate it with regard to the local, what we call interbank offered rate. It used to be LIBOR. LIBOR was the most important offered rate in all of these markets. The London interbank offered rate, LIBOR. What that simply meant was this. The banks do not have the funds, the 100 million, in their accounts. They don't need to have 100 million in their accounts. That's not how these markets work. What's going to happen in practice is this. The banks don't even have the 100 million in their accounts when they sign the loan agreement and tell the borrowers, you can draw this down. What happens is, when the borrowers need funds, they notify the agent bank, and the agent bank notifies the syndicate. The syndicate then goes into the market and draws down on the interbank market. So only when a borrower, one of these borrowers, asks for 1 million, 5 million, 10 million, whatever, that amount, only when that's notified to the agent bank and the agent bank notifies the syndicate member, does the syndicate member at that time then go into the market and draw down in the interbank markets to make those funds available. So what's the borrower going to pay? The borrower is going to pay the interbank offered rate, the IBOR. It used to be LIBOR, now we just call it an IBOR of any form, plus the margin, and the margin's the bank's profit. And we normally talk about this in BPS, basis points. So if the bank's profit is going to be 100 basis points or 200 basis points, it's IBOR plus margin. And we'll actually see that's actually provided for in the documentation. So what does the borrower pay? It pays the interbank rate plus the margin on top. 250 basis points is 2.5%. 350 is 3.5%. But the banks always get their margin. All that varies is the interbank offered rate on a daily basis, depending upon when the drawdown notices are served. Only at that stage do the banks go in, draw down the money, they then pay whatever that the relevant interest rate is at that time. And therefore, The calculation is that the borrower pays the local interbank offered rate, the IBOR, plus the margin. And then there's some other costs as well, and we'll see that when I give you diagrams explaining all of the documentation involved. We'll then also see there's a number of other ancillary charges that could come in, including tax charges and indemnities and various other fees and things, so we can work out exactly what the borrower is going to pay under the total facility, and we can do that by looking at tables and diagrams of how all of this works in practice, and we'll draw lines to show how all of the funds move in practice. Now, there was a scandal. During the global financial crisis, Barclays Bank in London had to admit that it overset, it overquoted, overpriced its LIBOR rate on a particular period, for a particular period, on particular days, over a certain period. It didn't do it for its own personal benefit. It did it because it didn't want the market to be concerned with Barclays' stability and then have a price attack, a run on its shares, and then for Barclays to get into financial difficulty, which could have triggered the collapse of Barclays and then the UK financial system. It did it for slightly more altruistic reasons. It wasn't just purely benefit. But a lot of people then became very concerned about the nature of operation of the old LIBOR system. The LIBOR system operated by having 16 banks report daily rates. It's called a timed system. Trimmed, it's called a trimmed system. Trimmed means this: 16 banks quote their expected overnight rate for that day. It's trimmed it. So you take out the top four, you take out the bottom four, you average the rest, and that's the daily LIBOR rate. But what happened was it was based on the bank's estimate of what they thought they were going to have to pay overnight to borrow on the markets. So it was a subjective estimate looking forward. They wanted to replace this because of this crisis, because Barclays had to admit that it had overquoted and there was litigation that followed from that. Regulators looked at this. There was what was called a Martin Wheatley report. Wheatley was the then head of the Financial Services Authority in London, which became the Financial Conduct Authority. And because of that, they decided to move on to new alternative risk-free rate systems. The current one is now called SONIA. So we don't talk about LIBOR in London, we talk about SONIA. SONIA is the sterling overnight interest average. Sterling overnight interest average, SONIA. So you'll see in all of the books and all of the papers, everybody talks about LIBOR. In London, we now talk about SONIA, sterling overnight interest average. In New York, we call it SOFR. That's the secured overnight funding rate, SOFR, S-O-F-R. In Europe, we have Euribor, which was a copy of the old LIBOR. But we also, in Europe, we have two alternatives. We have Eonia, E-O-N-I-A, and we have ESTER, E-S-T-E-R. ESTER is provided by the ECB on a daily basis. Eonia is provided by the European Banking Federation, although we still talk about Euribor in Europe. And all that simply means is, what's it going to cost for a large international bank to borrow on, to borrow euros on the interbank euro rate system? What's it going to cost overnight? That's the Euribor system. That's the Euribor figure. Okay? So we've now got separate IBORs, interbank offered rates. We have SONIA in London. We have SOFR in New York. We have Euribor in Europe. We have TIBOR is Tokyo. We have MIBOR is Mumbai. And we have SHIBOR is Shanghai. So we have different interbank offered rates in different countries. They're all operating on a very similar system. The objective is to try and remove that subjective element that was the problem within the earlier LIBOR model and considered to be a major failure when it was realized that we couldn't trust the banks in times of crisis, which occurred because of Barclays' disclosure. The way they calculate SONIA, the banks, the panel banks involved, they now report to the bank's sterling money market system on a daily basis, so it's all done electronically. It's an unsecured rate for one business lending. It's executed between 00, midnight, and 6 o'clock the same day for any banks with over 25 million in value, 25 million pounds in value. They have to report the rate that they would have to, they had to pay the day before for that amount, for that figure, and then we take a trimmed average of that again. You exclude the top group, you exclude the bottom group, and you average the ones in the middle, and that gives you the SONIA rate. We actually had SONIA before. It was actually set up in 1997. They used it in the swap markets. All they've done is they've taken it from the swap markets, transferred it over into the main banking markets, so it's now the basis for interbank lending in London. So we talk about that in terms of SONIA. In practice, what that means is the borrower will pay the bank's margin, that's the profit, plus the SONIA rate every day. And SONIA will vary, but the margin will always stay the same, and then any other additional charges that occur, we will add those as well. And then we have repayment. Repayment could again be in a single amount, which we call a bullet repayment, or it could be scheduled, it could be over a period, and where you repay the principal amount in installments during the last, for example, 2 years, we call that amortization. You say you amortize it by repaying the principal amount in installments over a certain period. So rather than pay £100 million back at the end, you're going to pay, for example, £5 million each month for a certain period, okay? Over a 20-month period. Those are all the core financial provisions. So any deal, you have the financials, and those are the five core sets of provisions. What will happen in practice simply is this. You'll become involved with a large deal. You might be brought in before it's set up to actually draft the documentation, or you might be brought in during the deal or to advise on some aspect of it. It's never a problem, even if you're looking at a 1,000-page document or a 10,000-page larger financial structured transaction system. What you simply do is this. You look for the financials. Where are the core financials? And then two other key points, which I highlighted earlier on in separate classes. You're always going to look for the financials as well as the obligations, and we're going to look at those in further detail, and then the default provisions. Those are the three key sets of measures. The financials, the obligations, and the defaults. If you understand those, you basically understand the deal. Now, the key point is this. You will know in advance what those are, where they should be, and roughly what the rates are, what they should look like. So just by going straight to those provisions, even if you've got a 1,000-page document, you never start on page one, start reading it page by page. You don't need to do that. You go straight into the financials, principal term, drawdown, interest, and repayment, straight to the obligations, straight to the defaults. And but if you understand those key provisions, you can understand everything. So even if it's a 1,000 or a 10,000 or a 20,000-page deal, you just look for those. Every time, straight into those, that's the core of the system, right? So we've got the financials, we need to understand the obligations, and then the defaults. So again, I've summarized those on the paper. The three sets of obligations are the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants. So we talk about the CPs, the reps and W's, and the covs. In practice, the way it appears is this. The CPs are pre-advance, or it appears the CPs are pre-agreement. Pre-deal. The reps and W's are pre-advance, and then the covs are post-advance. That's the way it looks in practice. But when we actually read these provisions and we actually understand how they work in practice, the CPs are actually pre-advance. That's pre-drawdown. The reps and W's come into effect before the agreement's entered into, so they're pre-agreement, and then the covs are post-agreement and post-drawdown. So we make a slight adjustment simply because of the nature of the actual content of the provisions. Now, the CPs generally apply to things like constitutional documentation. You need the articles, you need the resolutions, you need the memorandum, you need all the main documents that evidence that the borrowers are in existence, that they have right to conduct their business, and that they have right to draw down and borrow. So you'll take, as we've said before, you'll want resolutions, approvals, specimen signatures, all of this. You will also have other separate sovereign confirmations. If it's a large, complex deal, for example, in any particular market, there may be a need for state, government, or sovereign approval, so any sovereign confirmations. this market is usually unsecured. Because it's large, wholesale, interbank, usually it's unsecured. But specific deals will be secured, so you need to check the security and the effectiveness of the security. You'll also take legal opinions in all of these deals. Whenever you've got a cross-border element, you need a legal opinion and a legal opinion for every country that may be involved. So if all of these borrowers are in separate countries, you'll want a legal opinion from each one of those. And if there's security in another country, you'll want a legal opinion on the enforceability of the security clauses over that asset as well, okay? The legal opinions, and we'll come back to this separately, confirm the enforceability and the legal validity of the agreements that you're entering into. You cannot do that as a lawyer in London, so you will commission legal opinions from senior counsel in each of the jurisdictions that you're involved with, and you collect all of these. We need to know that this large, complex international finance deal is enforceable against all of the parties concerned and in all of the jurisdictions involved. So we'll take a legal opinion from each one. If each of the borrowers is based in a separate country, we'll need a legal opinion from there, as well as the governing law, if the governing law clause is different, as well as any security provisions. We'll come back and look at governing law later. All documents in the finance area, in these international markets, they close with a governing law and jurisdiction clause. The governing law and jurisdiction, that's two separate things. We have to select what law is going to govern the contract. And we have to select the courts that are going to hear any disputes. So we select those two. If we don't select them, they're automatically assigned under various Hague conventions, Lugano conventions, and other international arrangements, including the European regulations in this area. In practice, we select. The two most common governing laws are always English law and New York law. And the two most commonly used jurisdictions are always London and New York, simply because we have a highly sophisticated court system. We have a dedicated commercial court in London. We have judges who are doing this all day, every day. They're very familiar with this, and we have complete trust and reliance in the system. In many other parts of the world, we just do not have that. And when you're lending 100 million or 100 billion, you need to know that you can enforce this if anything goes wrong. So the two most commonly used governing laws are English and New York law, and the two most commonly selected jurisdictions will be London and New York. Now, they don't have to be the same. You could have New York law with London courts. So what will then happen is the London courts will apply New York law as the governing law for the transaction. That happens very common. Or it may well be that you have Saudi Arabian law held in London, or you can have different variations. What's happening is certain countries now want to assert more of their own sovereign identity. So we're seeing a bit more of this being moved around, although still the two most common selections, both for the governing law and the jurisdiction, are London and New York. I'll just mention state rules, state lending, briefly. When you're lending to a government, when it's a sovereign loan, there's usually two things we always have to deal with and have special clauses providing for. We always waive sovereign immunity. Countries can say, I'm immune, you can't sue me. Well, why would 10 banks lend 100 million? You waive the immunity clause. So you always have an immunity waiver clause, and usually, almost always, you'll require the governing law to be a separate court. Or either the governing law could be the same, but the jurisdiction very often will be separate. Because you might not trust the government to respect the rule, you might not be able to get the rule against it, so therefore, in sovereign lending, very often you may want to have a separate jurisdiction, and if you're concerned about the law as well, you'll have a separate governing law clause as well. For example, if you're learning, I'm not making any criticism in any way, but for example, Vietnam, Myanmar, even China, you may be concerned about the enforceability of the obligation against the state. Therefore, you'll take immunity clauses, and the governing law and the jurisdiction could be separate. Any other confirmations or other evidence that we require? And then what we call conditions subsequent. So these are called CPs, conditions precedent. We also may want conditions subsequent that you have to comply with afterwards as well. Now, what I said before, it looks like the CPs are pre-agreement. In practice, the CPs are pre-advance. The advance is each drawdown. So every time you're drawing down, all of this is going to be repeated because this might change. So if it's changed, you have to provide new up-to-date versions of it, as well as comply with any conditions subsequently. We then have the reps and W's. The reps and W's are the representations and warranties. These are undertakings and statements which form the basis on which the parties agree that the lending will be provided. Now, a representation is a statement of fact rather than opinion or law. So a rep is a statement of fact, not law. And a warranty is an undertaking to act, an undertaking to do something. Now, we'll come back and look at this in further detail. It's all in the paper, and I've provided all the case law in the text and in the footnotes in the paper. The key point is this. With regards to the reps and W's, these are generally not conditions. They're not full contractual provisions. They are duties, but they don't have full enforceability, the same as other provisions in the full contract may have. The key point is this. When you breach a rep or a W, you don't get rescission. And that's the key point that the banks want and the lawyers acting for the bank need. What they want to do is they want to elevate all the provisions so that if there's any breach of them, they get rescission, because that's the most powerful remedy, okay? They don't just want damages. So what you've got is this. There's a whole series of different types of terms with different grades and different importance in law. We have reps, we have warranties, we have conditions, we have other types of provisions which might be hybrid measures. The way we deal with it in practice is this. A rep and a warranty are different, but what we're going to do in the documentation, the way we're going to draft it, is we're going to represent and warrant. Do you see? So we elevate the representations to the warranties to try and make them the same in law. And what we're also then going to do is we want to elevate those again to make them the same as a condition, so that if it's breached, we get full rescission. So what we then do is we tie the reps and the W's, as well as the CPs and the CUVs, we tie them into the defaults. So we cross-refer all of this to the defaults. The point being, we're elevating all of them to make sure we get maximum series of remedies in the event that anything goes wrong. Now, what are the remedies? You'll see on the right-hand side in red. Default effects will go for suspension. Suspension is a further lending. You can't draw down more. Cancellation is when we cancel further lending, further drawdown. Acceleration is when we make a demand, and there's actually case law on this. You need to make a demand. If you're enforcing, you have to make a demand, although just by demanding repayment, that constitutes a demand. It doesn't have to use the word demand directly, and there's case law on this. You accelerate the repayment. And then you can rescind the contract, and then you can sue for full recovery afterwards. So there's five principal remedies. Suspension, cancellation, acceleration, rescission, and enforcement. We want to rescind it, but we're usually going to rescind as the absolute last remedy anyway. Why? Because we're always going to want to negotiate. And if anything goes wrong, we'll just reschedule. And there's a whole section at the end of the chapter on rescheduling, and I'll mention that. So what are the five remedies? Suspension, cancellation, acceleration, rescission, and enforcement. And the way we trigger those is we tie the reps and W's, the CPs, and the CUVs together, so the breach of any of these constitutes a default, therefore we trigger all the remedies. There's also some interesting case law in to what extent, if these haven't been complied with, can the banks cancel, as when there's an obligation to lend actually begin. There's some nice case law in there as well. I've put that in the text and in the footnotes. So, with the CPs, we have the reps and the W's. With the reps and the W's, we have legal warranties, and then we also have financial warranties. So legal warranties will include things like all the provisions are binding, there's no conflict, necessary power and authority, authorization, governing law and enforcement are in place, no immunity, action or other waiver provisions. What you'll see is this. A lot of it overlaps. So provisions which are referred to in the CPs will overlap with some of the measures in the reps, either the legal or the financials, as well as you'll then find them repeated again in the CUVs. and or overlap again with the defaults. That's done deliberately. It's just to make sure everything works. There's no uncertainty, there's no possible gap, there's no possible emissions. You'll see all of this. Now, what I'll do is I will give you a separate table. I've mentioned it already, but I'll give you a paper which summarizes the main standard documentation we use in this area is prepared by the Loan Market Association in London as the Key Trade Association. I will give you a summary of that. So I've got a two-page summary of the LMA document. It's 100 pages, but we can reduce it to two pages, front and back, so we can see how all this works. And what we'll then do is we'll go through, I said already, we'll do this when we look at the fees and the payment obligations of the borrower. We can just draw lines to connect sections so we can see how it all fits, how it all comes alive. We will see that again when we understand how all these different sets of obligations overlap with the defaults and then with the remedies that we've got. So we have legal warranties and then we have financial and commercial warranties, basically tied to the financial condition of the borrower before the loan agreement's entered into and then before drawdown. So, and again, very many of these will be repeaters. They're repeated. They're either evergreens or repeaters so that they stand in place all the time. They have to be compliant with at all times, or they're repeated at certain times, usually when you have a drawdown. So we have evergreens and repeaters as well. So reps, legals, and the financials. And then we have the corporate covs. The covs are the main obligations that the borrower has entered into following drawdown under the facility. Now, what's the purpose of these? The purpose of these is to limit the credit risk to the banks. What is the credit risk? The credit risk is the risk of counterparty default. It's the risk that the borrower won't repay principal on maturity and interest during term. Principal on maturity and interest during term. So how do we limit that credit risk? The banks will conduct their own credit assessment at the beginning to assess the credit worthiness and value of the borrower. But then once the funds are available, what we're going to do is this. We want to take as much control as we can over the activities of the borrower without becoming what we call a shadow director. The banks don't want to be held liable for taking decisions on behalf of the company just in case the company does anything, a misconduct, for example, sanctions, breaches, or whatever else. The banks don't want to become shadow directors. But below being a shadow director, they want to try and exercise as much control as they can over the activities of the borrower. And we can do that through the covs. That's principally what they're for. And what we'll see is this. We've got the corporate covs, we've got the negative pledge, the pari passu and disposals. The negative pledge is security. You cannot give any senior security, any prior security, which will be contrary to the bank's interest, which will undermine the bank's recovery. So we'll see the negative pledge, we'll look at that in further detail. Pari passu, all other obligations which are entered into in similar terms with any other groups of banks, any other syndicates, have to be on identical terms. They cannot have any priority. And then asset disposal. You cannot make any material disposal of assets which will undermine the bank's ability to recover against your assets in the event of a default. So those are the most important, what we call the corporate covs. And then we have the financial covs, which are equally as important, arguably even more important. What the financial covs do is they impose certain financial ratios. This becomes even more important in the project finance deals we talked about before. Identify, I think, about 25 different ratios in my chapter on project finance. For our purposes, there's a series of core financial ratios. Minimum net worth, MNV. Earnings to interest rate is the EBIT, what we call the EBITDA. We've consolidated net debt. We have debt to earnings, dividend limits, liquidity, leverage limits, and then earnings to interest, the EBITDA, as well as the minimum net worth. And all of this I've explained in the footnotes to the chapter. What we can basically do is this. We can exercise a very substantial amount of preservation, control over the activities of the company by making sure they stay within these financial limits. It's a very effective way of effectively managing the business indirectly. We don't become shadow directors and take separate decisions on individual activities on a day-to-day basis of the company, but we make sure that the company stays within these certain core financial limits, usually with regards to capital cover, liquidity cover, and always retaining enough funds to pay interest and repay principal. You can exercise a very substantial amount of control through the use of these financial cuffs. So the corporate cuffs and the financial cuffs, together with the information supply obligation, we require the borrowers to make lots of information available on a continuing basis, in particular if any difficulties arise, through a combination of information, financial cuffs, corporate cuffs, the banks can protect their interest in the loan, and they can ensure that the borrower is always in a condition to be able to repay the loan, to service the loan by paying interest, and then to repay principal on maturity. And then we may have some other general undertakings as well at the end, which I've referred to at the bottom. So these are all the core obligations. The CPs, the reps and Ws, and the cuffs, and through a combination of these in practice, we set up the relationship so that we are satisfied the borrower is in a condition and will always be able to repay, and then we protect our interest in the business of the borrower through the combination of these corporate cuffs and financial cuffs. We get the early information through the CPs and the reps and Ws, in particular the financial warranties, but we can then protect and control, preserve our interest subsequently, mainly through the cuffs, the corporate cuffs and the financial cuffs, which is supported by all the information supply that's made available. In terms of default, if anything does go wrong, we have a series of express default triggers that will exercise rights to step in and do something. Non-payment, obviously. If there's non-payment of principal or interest, breach of the financial cuffs is an express event of default. Other non-financial breach, any separate misrepresentation, and we'll come back and look at liability separately as well, and then cross default. The two most difficult default provisions to draft are the cross default and the material adverse change, the MAC. The cross default and the MAC. And they actually work together in practice. The issue about the cross default is this. If you trigger cross default on your loan agreement, that's going to automatically trigger cross default on virtually all other outstanding obligations that the company's got with other borrowers at any one point, other lenders at any one point in time, right? So the purpose of the cross default is that it creates a default when there's a breach on any other lending commitments. So when the other banks on the other lending commitments call cross default, what that in practice means that everything cross defaults. So what effectively happens is that if you trigger cross default, you're basically heading for insolvency. No renegotiation, no rescheduling, no discussion, no delay, no thinking. It's basically default. So you have to be very careful. You will always take a cross default clause, but you just have to be careful when you actually exercise it, if you've got any discretion to exercise it in practice. Because once you trigger this, it will trigger the cross default in all the other outstanding obligations, which very often might mean full insolvency of the borrower, which means you will have to rank. And again, you remember, you're usually unsecured, so you will just rank with all the other claimants against the borrower in practice. Very important clause. We need the protection, we need that available, but it's just a question of when we exercise it. If we're too quick, we may prejudice our own interest. If we're not quick enough, somebody else may come in and get priority. It's a difficult one in practice. We have to watch this. This is the type of clause you'll be asked for advice on. The other difficult one is the MAC at the end, material adverse change. With a MAC clause, what you're trying to do is this. If there's any significant downturn in the condition of the markets or the condition of the borrower, which could be against your interest, you want to trigger a default. But you have to be very careful how you draft this. If it's too generous and it's too easy to trigger, the company could always be in default. If it's too hesitant and too careful, it's ineffective in practice. So it's a difficult one to get right. So again, a lot of time is spent negotiating the MAC clause and the cross defaults. I will give you some sample clauses on the system so you can see how these look in practice. Very important, you want a residual protection, a residual ability to step in. The problem is you don't want to trigger it too easy.
in particular, because if you trigger a Mac under this, that may automatically trigger a cross default in something else. You have to be careful with these provisions. There's then some other obvious clauses. If there's insolvency, if there's other creditor process, if there's a loss of control or other illegality, or if the borrower, one or more of the borrowers, repudiate, in all of these cases, we're going to trigger a default. What happens on default? We have our remedies. The key threat, the most powerful remedy of itself, is the threat of rescission and acceleration. But in practice, the banks aren't going to want to do that. They're not going to want to use that, because what do they want? They want repayment. In most situations, you will renegotiate. That's virtually always what will happen. You want to renegotiate, but you want to renegotiate from a position of strength. So if you have all of these protections, all of these default clauses, including specifically an express right of rescission and acceleration, you have maximum ability to put pressure on the borrower to get the best possible repayment terms. I've also got a separate chapter on the book, on the system, on loan restructuring. We look at rescheduling. We have what we call the Paris Club, the London Club, and then we have other International Monetary Fund and World Bank facilities, in particular what we call the HIPICs for heavily indebted countries. We have special negotiation arrangements for them. The two most important private clubs are the Paris Club and the London Club. London Club was set up, I think, in 1967. It's more to do with corporate lending and how you can renegotiate, restructure corporate loans. The banks come together as a group and they negotiate with the borrower. It's not only in London. These meetings can be held in New York, Shanghai, Hong Kong and elsewhere. The Paris Club is for sovereign restructurings and is almost always in Paris. The meetings used to be always headed by someone from the finance ministry in Paris. That was for sovereign restructurings. So what would happen is, if a country gets into difficulty and the borrowers want to renegotiate with it, they can set up meetings through the Paris Club. In practice, what will happen is this. Sovereign lenders, including international financial institutions, they never want to cancel the debt. What they will do is extend the maturity and lower the interest rate. Pay longer, a little less, but make sure we still get paid at the end. With private deals, there's more flexibility, and very often you'll have write-offs. So you may see a 10, 15, 20, 35% write-off of the private debt, but then you keep the sovereign debt. In practice, you will, as I've said, try to continue to pay for the sovereign lenders and international financial institutions. There may be some flexibility on the private debt. We saw that, for example, with the global financial crisis and countries negotiating with groups, lender groups, including, for example, Greece. There was a substantial knockdown in the private debt volume. I think it was about 35%. At least was written off. Although the sovereign lenders and the international financial institutions, they wanted repaid in full. But they agreed to pay longer, lower interest rate to allow the company to restructure. The other point that comes up with these negotiations in practice, however, the other issue is that you can then mix the bank lending with the capital market, the notes and the bonds. That becomes even more complex. The general rule is, if you're a company or you're a sovereign, you always repay your capital market debt first. You repay the bonds and the notes because you always want to be able to get back into the market. So if you're in difficulty, you repay the notes and the bonds and you try and renegotiate your loans. You try and cancel your private debt and then get the best extensions you can on your sovereign debt or IFI debt. But you always try to continue to make your payments on your capital market stuff, simply because that protects your ability to get back into the market. We have seen some recent instances when that was breached, in particular with Argentina. It decided to cancel some of its capital market debt. But general rule is you pay your notes and bonds in full, try to renegotiate your outstanding bank positions. Your bank positions, you'll try to get any haircuts or deductions, cancellations on the private debt, and then just the most generous extensions you can get on the sovereign and IFI debt, either through extended periods or lower interest rates. All of this is on the table. The only other couple of points we haven't mentioned are, for example, syndication. We need to consider the relationship between the banks as a group who are making the funds available. This gets quite complex in practice. We've said already the relationship is several, not joint and several. The reliability is several. But also what happens is this. These are large professional international institutions. They're dealing with each other on a face-to-face basis. So it's equal terms. So the general principles are equality. And what I've simply tried to do is summarize the key provisions in the documentation there. So we have severality, proportionality, equality, and then limited agency function. Because they're large professional institutions, there's very limited delegation of function. If there is going to be majority voting, most of it's consensus. If there is majority voting, it will be a qualified majority, so it's not, it's 66 3/4 rather than 50%, right? It's not simple majority, it's qualified majority. But in practice, the large banks won't want to surrender the exercise of the rights to a majority decision. When it comes to important provisions on principle and term, they'll want to decide these themselves. So limited delegation of function. But in practice, the other provisions, what they support is severality of liability, proportionality of contribution, equality of rights and entitlement, and then democracy, full rights to vote and exercise their own protections in practice. And then I've mentioned limited delegation. The limited delegation then corresponds in practice virtually identically with the role and function of the agent bank. We've already mentioned you'll have an arranging bank, sets up the facility, gets paid a large fee, usually 0.5% of a 100 billion facility. That's a large amount of money. You can set these up in a month, 2 months. And then at the same time, you'll have more than one operating, so you'll be running two or three at the same time, and then just move on to the next one. You don't stay to make your lending, as we've said before. You bring another bank in to take on your participation. So the arranging bank steps down, goes on to manage the next deal, set up the next transaction. The agent bank comes in and then administers the facility once it's up and running. So what are the functions of the agent bank? I've summarized them there. Payment duties, banking duties, notification duties, default duties. So there's a whole series of specific powers the agent bank has to exercise when these happen. In practice, this is more mechanical. It's almost administrative. So the agent bank gets paid on a sort of almost like an hourly basis. Time basis, it's much, much less. Like very, very substantially less than the arranging bank. So the agent bank and the arranging bank sound compatible. They are not. The arranging bank comes in, it's large investment bank, sets up the deal, takes a very large fee and is going to leave. Agent bank's going to stay for the duration of the facility, 20 years possibly, 30 years, 40 years if it's a IFI facility. It's going to do all the administrative, executive type work with the banks remaining in charge and in control with very limited voting and very limited delegation of function. The only other points then are the issues on liability. So we'll come back and look at this in further detail. I have a separate paper on agent bank and arranging bank liability. We need to consider the heads of liability. It's mainly to do with misrepresentation. We can have innocent misrepresentation, negligent misrepresentation, and fraudulent misrepresentation under common law. And then we can have statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act. And we also have statutory deceit under the Theft Act. We need to look at this in further detail. The point simply is, in practice, you're going to be preparing all of this documentation. You're drafting all of these clauses. You're making all of these facilities available. It's very easy for people to misstate points, to misremember, or to exaggerate. And one of your core responsibilities is to look for that and protect everyone against that. It's very easy for your client to misrepresent their position. And that could either be innocent, negligent, or fraudulent, as we've said already. It's your responsibility to prevent this. So we'll see this when we look at the actual documentation.
the documents we're coming on to look at in more detail. We have the mandate letter, we have the term sheet, the information memorandum. There's the procedure, which I've summarised on the system as well, then the fees. Those are the key documents and procedures that we're going to enter into. We need to take an initial mandate, get a mandate, an appointment to set up the facility. The term sheet is going to be the core financial provisions, which we outline. It used to be in a telex initially. They were quite simple, maybe only one page. Now, what effectively happens is the whole of the loan agreement is summarised in the form of a term sheet. And we have standard term sheets in practice. They're basically mini loan agreements. All the schedule, all the headings from the loan agreement, we have in a term sheet. And we'll just mark it up, we'll score bits out, add bits in. We get a really neat final term sheet, which we exchange. So it summarises the deal pre-negotiation. And then all of that will be reflected in the final loan document, but also the information memorandum. This is the important one from the borrower's perspective. The information memorandum explains the position of the borrower, its history, its activities, its operations, the specific use and targeted application of the funds it's drawing down, and how it's going to generate sufficient funds to repay the loan. All of that set out in the information memorandum. The parallel in the securities markets in a bond issue or an equity issue is a prospectus. It's the same thing, or a listing particular. These are virtually all identical in practice. The key issue, however, is this. The information memorandum, it's very easy for the company to misstate something, to exaggerate, to omit, to overstate, to make it look better than it actually is. You have to be very careful as the lawyer looking at this. You have to watch for this misrepresentation. And as I said, it could be innocent, negligent, or even fraudulent. The most important protections are now made available when it's statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. And so very carefully, you're looking through all the documentation, you're checking everything, and you're just making sure everything looks appropriate. Where necessary, you're asking for everything to be confirmed. Where a point's unclear, pass it back to the client every time. Because if that isn't corrected, if there is misrepresentation, there will be liability later. And there will be suit, there will be action. So you have to be very careful about this. So we'll come back, we'll look at this. Other heads of liability: theft, fraud, negligent, innocent, regulation. The theft is basically the statutory deceit I mentioned before. And then you can have possible regulatory liability. In the loan area, it's very limited because most of what we're doing is excluded from the regulatory provisions, which mainly focus on securities. Bonds are securities, notes are securities, but loan agreements aren't. There is some case law. There's a famous decision called the Fons decision, F-O-N-S. In that specific case, they considered a debenture to include a syndicated loan, so it was covered. It could have fallen within the definition of a security, but that was generally dismissed on its facts. It's not generally supported as creating regulatory liability for negotiating these syndicated loans. We generally assume, it's generally understood in practice, that these do not create regulatory liability by themselves, but I deal with this in further detail in the separate paper that I have on liability. As I've said, Theft Act is the statutory deceit. The key liability we're looking at are the fraudulent, negligent, and innocent misrepresentation and statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act, which is applied in practice through what's called the Misrepresentation Act, the Unfair Contract Terms Act, 1977 as well. And we will come back and look at all of that. It's dealt with in further detail in the chapter provided. But what we can do is, with all of this, we can understand a typical loan transaction, a typical Euroloan deal, a typical international lending arrangement. What I've also done is I've provided a full chapter that supports all of this. I've also made available a set of slides, and what we'll then go on to do is compare this with the loan and the bond structures. I've got a large number of other tables, 16 tables altogether, which explain how all of this works in practice.